Well, I get to recite this strange, strange story for you. It's in Numbers, starting in chapter 22. The Israelites set out and camped in the plains of Moab, across the Jordan from the Jericho. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw that all Israel had done for the Amorites. Moab was in great dread of the people because they were so numerous. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "This horde will now lick us up, all that is surround us, as the ox licks the grass of the field." Now Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at the time. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, in Pethor, which is in the Euphrates in the land of Ammah, to summon him, saying, "A people has come out of Egypt. They have spread over the face of the earth, and they have settled next to me. Come now, curse the people for me, since they are stronger than I. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that whomever thou bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed." So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with their fees for divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam and gave him Balak's message. Now on to 23. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Build me 7 altars here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me." Balak did as Balaam had said, and Balak and Balaam offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Stay here beside your burnt offerings while I go aside. Perhaps the Lord will come and meet me. Whatever he shows me, I will tell you." And he went to a bare height. Then God met Balaam, and Balaam said to him, "I have arranged the 7 altars and have offered the bull and the ram on each altar." The Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, "Return to Balak, and this is what you must say." So he returned to Balak and was standing beside the burnt offering with all the officials of Moab. Then Balaam uttered his oracle, saying, "Balak has brought me from Aram, the king of Moab from the eastern mountains. Come, curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. But how can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom the Lord has not denounced? For from the top of the crags I see him, from the hills I behold him. Here is a people living alone and not reckoned itself among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the dust cloud of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let me end be like his." Then Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? I brought you to this curse the enemies, but now you have done nothing but bless them." He answered, "Must I not take care to say what the Lord has put into my mouth?"
Thank you, Don. I can't imagine choosing anybody else to read that story ever again. Well, friends, brothers and sisters in Christ, this morning we gather ourselves around God's fire. Once again, like campers on a starlit night, settling in to listen to a story. So let the characters of that story hover around us like smoke, to let the story spark new ideas and burn dreams of new possibilities into our collective consciousness. Here in this place, we pause once again to warm ourselves around God's ancient fire, and today to consider what it means to follow a God of strange advocates. This morning, we find the Israelites where we found them the last few Sundays, on the outskirts of the Promised Land, waiting to finally get into their new home. They haven't been doing very well. Today's story comes from the book of Numbers, and for all the ways in which the Torah indicates that the Israelites were hard-hearted and stiff-necked, there's probably nothing that indicts them the way the book of Numbers does. The book is almost entirely one long indictment of ingratitude, refusal to trust, and spiritual presumption. Except for this. Near the end of a book that's all about how undeserving these stiff-necked people are of God's blessing, there's this. As the Israelites are setting up camp in Moab, just across the Jordan from their promised land, Balak, the king of Moab, looks out over these migrants capped on his border, and he does not like what he sees. "Look at all these people," he tells his advisors. "They're going to nibble away everything around us like an ox nibbles the grass on the field. They're going to infest us like a bunch of rats infest a city." And so Balak gets an idea. He sends for a guy named Balaam. He sends for Balaam because Balaam is the local seer, or fortune teller, or magician, or hexer. We don't really have people like Balaam in our culture anymore, so it's hard to find the right word for him, but perhaps the equivalent that might conjure it up for us best and be in keeping with the time of year would be to say he's a witch. Or I guess, since he's a dude, he's a warlock. A witchy dude in a time when witchy people were believed to have actual witch powers, like the ability to put a hex or a curse on people. He's a pagan witch. And so Balak sends his messengers out to his man Balaam with this message. "Look at all these dirty Israelite rats infesting my border. Would you curse them for me so they'll be weakened and then I can swoop in and mop them up? For I know that your powers work. I've seen it. I know that when you bless someone, they're blessed. And when you curse someone, they're cursed." And so Balak's messengers bring the message to Balaam. And Balaam says to the messengers, "Stay for the night. Let me ask God about it." Now I know what you're thinking. This pagan witch is going to ask God about it? Like the God? Like our God? The Israelites' God? Yahweh? Well, apparently, yes. We don't know why or how or when this pagan started consulting Yahweh, but the text is clear that that's what he says he needs to do. And so he does. And he seems to have developed a pretty tight relationship with God because God shows up that night and says the equivalent of, "Hey, Balaam, what's up? What's with these weird dudes staying the night at your house?" And Balaam responds with, "Yeah, God, they're here on behalf of Balak. They want me to go curse that Israelite migrant caravan camped out by the border." And God says, "Don't go." And so Balaam wakes up and tells the messengers, "Tell Balak I'm not coming." So the messengers bring the message back to Balak. And Balak says, "No, no, no, no. Go back and tell Balaam that this is going to be huge for him. Tell him that if he does this, he'll be in good with me. Tell him that I'm a rich guy and that I'll make him a rich guy too. Tell him that I'll do whatever he wants for him if he does this job for me." So the messengers go back and bring this message to Balaam. And Balaam says, "Look, I don't care how much the king offers me. When I consult Yahweh on things big or small, I say what Yahweh puts in my mouth, not what you or Balak or anyone else wants me to say. But go ahead and stay the night again, and I'll see if God has anything new to say." So that night, God comes to Balaam again and says, "Okay, fine then. Balaam, if Balak still wants to mess with all this, go see him. But remember the plan. Only say what I put in your mouth." So Balaam goes with Balak's men. And then something weird happens. Either God gets nervous about whether Balaam's really going to do what he said he will, or God knows that Balaam's heart is starting to entertain thoughts of getting rich by doing what the king is asking him to do, because God now suddenly sends a messenger to Balaam's donkey. That's right, to the donkey. Balaam can't see him, but a messenger from God appears on the road with his sword out, and he stands in front of Balaam's donkey that he's riding, and the donkey swerves off the road and into the field. But Balaam can't see God's messenger, so he keeps steering the donkey back onto the road. But the donkey's not going to mess with this sword-wielding dude on the road, so the donkey just presses up against the fence beside the field, which means he's crushing Balaam's leg. So Balaam starts to beat his donkey harder and harder. And then, and this is how the Bible literally puts it, then the Lord opened the donkey's mouth, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" And Balaam says, "Because you're messing with me, donkey. Believe me, if I had a sword, I would kill you right now." And the donkey says, in what I'm almost embarrassed to admit, I find to be one of the most touching verses in the Bible, "Am I not your donkey whom you have ridden your whole life till this day? Have I ever done anything bad to you before?" And Balaam says, "No, I guess not." And just then, God reveals the dude on the road with the sword to Balaam too. And Balaam now flattens himself to the ground. And God's messenger immediately delivers God's super important message of, "Yo, Balaam, why are you treating your donkey like that?" It's the first thing he says. By the way, I just love that that's his opening line. I mean, there's really important business to do here, but let's get this donkey treatment issue sorted out first. And I mean, fair enough, she seems like a really nice donkey. But then the messenger even doubles down on the donkey guilt trip by saying, "By the way, Balaam, if the donkey had tried to cross me, I would have killed you and let the donkey live. You realize that you just beat your donkey for saving your life, right?" And so Balaam apologizes to the messenger, though I wonder if the donkey noticed he still didn't directly apologize to her, and tries to change the subject to what he suspects this is really about. "Does God want me to turn around and go back home?" "Nah," says the messenger. "This whole big thing was just to send you a little reminder. Remember, when you get to Balak's, only say the words that I put in your mouth, that God puts in your mouth." And so Balaam and his faithful, underappreciated donkey continue on their way to Balak's. And they arrive. And Balak says, "What's the deal? Why didn't you come to me sooner? Didn't you hear the part about how I'm going to make you rich and powerful?" And Balaam says, "Fine, let's just do this. But remember, I'm telling you, I can only speak the words that God puts in my mouth." And Balak's like, yeah, yada, 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 let's get on with the cursing. And so Balak takes Balaam up to a high place where they can see all those Israelite migrants camped on the border, and he says, "Do it, Balaam." And so Balaam says, "All right, Balak, build me 7 altars and sacrifice a bull and a ram on each one, and then you go away a little while I wait to see what words God puts in my mouth." So Balak does it. And God arrives, as the Bible puts it, puts a word in Balaam's mouth. And then God, and I at least imagine God kind of giggling here, God says, "So Balaam, why don't you go spit these words out to Balak and see what he thinks about them?" So Balaam does. He goes to Balak and he says, "From my home did Balak leave me. The king of Moab from the eastern mountains, he said, 'Go curse the people of Israel and doom them.' But what can I hex that God has not hexed? Who can I doom that God has not doomed? From the top of these crags I see them, and from these hills I gaze on them. Look, it's a people all their own. A people who reckon themselves to be doing their own thing. Who can count all the good they've sprinkled in this world? When my time comes, let me die an upright death like these incredible people will." And Balak is like, "What? Man, I hired you to curse these people, and you just blessed them." And Balaam's like, "Hey, I told you, I'm just going to say what God puts in my mouth." So Balak says, let's try this again. Let's go to a place where we can only see some of them, if you're squinting. And let's see if God will maybe give you a different word to say if you're not looking at all of them when you pray about it. And so they do it all again in another place where they can't see all the Israelites. And Balaam comes back to Balak again, and Balak says, okay, give it to me now. What are you going to say about these Israelites now? And Balaam says, okay, here's the word that God put in my mouth. Look, God's not some human who has a change of heart on this. The Lord God is with Israel like a trumpet blast in their midst. And let this be said to anyone who plans to attack them, God would rear those people up like a lion, a very, very thirsty lion. And Balak's like, no. You know what? I have another idea. Let's do this all again. But this time, let's go to a place where we can't see any of these Israelites, to a wasteland where we can't see anything at all. Come with me to Peor, where all you can see is nothing, and let's do it all again. So Balaam goes with Balak again, and they do it all again. And Balaam comes back to Balak, and Balak's like, okay, give it to me now. Will you say this curse on the Israelites for me? And Balaam says, okay, here's the word that God put in my mouth. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like palm groves they stretch out, like gardens by a river, like aloes that the Lord himself has planted, like cedars by water. Water drips from Israel's branches, and Israel's roots are abundant in water. Israel's leader is greater than any other king. Israel can consume any foe. Like a lion, Israel can... And at this point, it's easy to imagine Balak screaming, enough! Don't say another word. I get the point. I get it. Just stop. And as the Bible says, Balaam rose and went and returned to his place, and Balak too went on his way. And that, my friends, is the strange story of a pagan witch who was offered riches and power to curse Israel, but instead became their strange advocate. All because he spoke what God put in his mouth. And that, my friends, is how the Israelites, at a moment when they may have least deserved blessings, still got a blessing because this strange advocate decided to speak what God put in his mouth. You know, the whole thing reminds me of another story, this time a story that I've lived through. As I've mentioned before, Shanda and I, and sometimes Jill, have long directed a youth camp, one that Jocelyn and Ari now go to. And there was a time when a number of the churches who sent their youth to our camp began to have some questions about whether they could trust our staff with their kids. In particular, leaders in some of these supporting churches worried what it might mean that some of the staff at our camp were advocates in their own churches back home for LGBTQ inclusion. And so some of the churches supporting us wondered, would that mean that our camp would lead their kids astray? So there were times, many times, in fact, where I feared that our camp might not survive the conflict that was brewing about this. But then an interesting thing happened. The moderator of the conference that oversaw our camp, we'll call him John, decided that he would just come to check it out for himself. He would simply volunteer to be a counselor, and he'd see what really was or wasn't happening at this camp. So he did. And I have to admit that a number of our staff were not pleased. You see, some of the staff perceived John as the last person to ever be willing to talk civilly about some of the hard issues that were at play in this conflict. I won't lie, there were whispers among our staff that John was not really there to be a counselor, but he was there to be a spy. He was just there collecting evidence to support the decision he'd already made to tell the conference to fire all of our current staff. On his end, I now realize that John probably also had fears about coming to be a counselor with us, like he might be entering a lion's den of itself, a lion's den full of folks ready to pounce on him for his more traditional views. But John is nothing if not a brave guy, and he came. That year, our speaker, who knew little about this tension, led us in a prayer activity that I would, to be honest, be a little uncomfortable leading myself. I'm not sure I'll ever do it with you. The activity was called banner reading, and in it, they led all of the campers and staff in a prayer exercise wherein all of us would pray for one other person in the room. But here's the catch. You didn't know who you were praying for until after you'd prayed. In other words, the speaker would choose one person, not tell us who that person was, and then invite us to listen for any words God put in our mouths and images God put in our minds for that person that we didn't yet know who they were. And then we'd call out what came to us. The speakers would write them down, and then at the end they'd announce which person God was sending all those words and images to. And so in one of these first sessions, we all, staff and campers together, called out with images and words God was giving us for someone in the room that the speaker had not yet chosen to reveal to us. We called out images and words that were full of deep comfort, that were meant to empower someone, that had deep affirmations in them, that had details that we later learned were very specific to that person. And then the speakers announced to all of us that John had been the one that we were praying for. John, who many of us on staff perceived to be a spy sent to take the staff down, was the one that God had given us words of comfort, empowerment, and affirmation from. For. I don't remember exactly what those words are anymore, but what I do remember is John leaping to his feet and weeping. I remember him through his tears trying to find the words to tell us that this was exactly what he needed to hear in his life right now. Now, I'm glad that our campers and staff aren't pagan witches. Rather, they're very fervent followers of Jesus. But I can say this. That day, I got a Balaam-style glimpse of what it means for people to be called by God to be someone else's strange and surprising advocate. That day, I got a Balaam-style glimpse of the surprising words God can put in our mouths when we look at those fears we fear most, those we don't ever think we could talk to about issues like sexuality, those we may have decided to label as spies or problems or impossible to talk to, those in our very faith communities that we secretly think we could never have a hard conversation with. That day I got a Balaam-style glimpse of the fact that when we live as God's people, and particularly when we actually listen for the words that God might be putting in our mouths for one another, we might actually be a motley collection of very surprising advocates for one another. We might be a collection of people that are invited by this world, sometimes even the leaders of our world, to curse one another. But we somehow shock ourselves when we hear something very different come out of our word, out of our mouths, when we hear the word put in there that God gave us. You know, you should know one more thing about John. The blessing that God poured out on us strange advocates that day didn't end with just us becoming John's advocates. John went back to those who had concerns about our staff, some of whom I experienced as having those concerns in very sincere and loving ways, but a few of whom I found to have expressed those concerns in ways that were full of anger and brutal unkindness towards some of us. John went back to all of those who had concerns about us, and John then turned around and advocated for us. I trust that John did so because those were the words God put in his mouth too. Not because I think that someone speaking God's words would only ever have good things to say about the camp that I helped to run, but because, as I've gotten to know John better and better, mostly because of this experience, I've known him to be a man who listens very carefully, tries to be very faithful about the words that God puts in his mouth. because he has spoken words that I've since trusted to be coming from God in other areas of my life too. Like, as I've told you before, in telling me more definitively than anyone that God wanted me to come here. Friends, we follow a God that brings us into community with strange advocates. We also live at a time when those of us who go to church together are sometimes terrified of talking with each other about things like politics and sexuality. I get it. Those topics scare me right now, too. But I'm also convinced by Scripture and by my own journey that we follow a God who, when we're truly listening for it, gives us the most surprising, life-giving words to share with one another. Not empty or superficial words that come as we try to avoid talking about fear and differences, but instead words that come to us in the midst of conflict and potential conflict. Words so surprising that they make us strange and incredibly wonderful advocates for one another. Words that are so strange and wonderful that we will know later, if not immediately, that surely this is what God has put into our mouths.